Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Today, I'm pleased to welcome back Jeff Epping, Director of Horticulture at Olbrich Botanical Gardens in Madison. He hasn't been with us in a while, so it's great to have him back. And we're going to zero in a little bit on planning for a good winterscape and using ornamentals to do that. And I think Jeff is of the opinion that we can have a really interesting winter garden as well as one in the summer. You may have some questions for him, and I hope you'll join in. Do you think about what plants will make an interesting winterscape when you plan your yard and garden? Or what plants do you include and why? Do you use ornamental grasses? That's something else we want to talk about. What are your favorites? Jeff's got some favorites, and I'm sure he'll be happy to share those favorites with us. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or go to our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, and you can post a question or a comment there. And Jeff, good to have you back.
It's great to be here. Thanks.
Been a while.
Absolutely.
It's too long. And because it has been too long, I want to go back to Olbrich for a bit. For those people who aren't familiar with Olbrich Botanical Garden, tell us about the variety of gardens you have there. It's amazing.
You bet. We're right here on the east side of Madison, free garden. Yeah. It costs you a buck to get in the conservatory, but other than that, you can come out and see us. We're all about, giving people ideas about what they might be able to do in their own garden. So this time of year, the ornamental grasses are front and center, along with lots of beautiful fall colors still hanging on. We have a number of interesting gardens, perennial garden, rose garden that still looks great right now, sunken garden, herb garden, rock garden, so on and so forth, and a very unusual garden called a Thai garden, which is a nice addition and a gift of a beautiful Thai pavilion from our friends over in Thailand a few years back.
Beautiful, absolutely beautiful. And my wife phoned me, actually it was last night. She was driving by the garden. She said, "We haven't been to the gardens, the Olbrich gardens, for probably close to a month." And she said, "It looks just beautiful over there." So sometime this weekend we'll be over there to take in what the fall colors and so forth look like.
You bet. It's supposed to be a beautiful weekend, so be a good one for a trip.
And the Bolts Conservatory is 20 years old?
Right. 20 years old this year. Big anniversary celebration next weekend. So we're hoping to see lots of people out for that. We have a event called Party Under the Palms on Friday evening, and then we have lots of great events on the weekend.
I usually talk to my classes at the UW with the students, and I said one of the best possible dates that you could have, and it doesn't cost a whole lot. And I described the Bolts Conservatory, and I said you can take a date there for a dollar.
Absolutely, it doesn't get any better than that.
You can't get any better than that with these beautiful plants, and especially in the winter, in the middle of the winter, and you nice benches to sit and talk. And I said then you can go down Atwood Avenue and find a little restaurant and have something to eat. It's perfect.
It is perfect. In the winter when it's so cold and miserable out, it's certainly a nice place to visit.
Oh, man. Well, Mary in Madison has a question for you, so let's go there. Hi, Mary. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I love the idea of having something interesting in the garden in the winter, and I bought a Harry Lauder's walking stick, my most expensive plant by far, and put in my front yard, and it kind of made it for 2 years and then died, and I'm devastated. And I'm trying to figure out if I did something wrong and to try again, or if I shouldn't invest that much again.
What? Maybe you can describe that plant for us.
Okay, it's called that. Well, let's see. It's real curly.
Right, right. Harry Lauder's walking stick is a curly variety of the European hazelnut. And so it really is at its best in the winter after the foliage drops because of this beautiful, upright, curly nature. Yeah. The one problem with that plant that we've seen been worse over the last 5 years is the Japanese beetles absolutely love it. It's like a magnet for them. So they often sort of, you know, put the plant into a little bit of stress in a year where, you know, the Japanese beetles are at their worst. This year was so-so. They came out later. We thought we, you know, we weren't going to have them too bad, but they actually hit a little later in the season. And, yeah, they can be rough on them. There's also a canker disease that affects that plant. And we have lost a couple over the years. Generally, we get about 5 to 8 years out of a plant and seem to lose it. Now, it's not always the case. I mean, you know, depends on the conditions it's in and how happy it is. But there are others, you know.
That's what I was wondering. Is there some alternative that is more likely to make it here?
Right. There's some nice varieties actually now of willows, some curly willows that will, you get the same sort of effect too. And actually, maybe even a better effect for the fact that they have colorful bark as well.
Oh.
There's curly varieties. There's others that are just more straight and upright. One of my favorites is called the coral bark willow, Salix alba britsensis is the cultivar. And if you come out to Olbrich, you'll see them highlighted in the perennial garden. And so it's a plant that, you know, we let get about 15 feet tall. We cut it to the ground and let it come back again. It's actually a tree that wants to be about 60 feet tall. But we cut it to the ground about every third year and put them on a cycle so that we don't do them all in the same season. But it's a great plant. I have it in my little garden at home, and there I cut it back even more often because I don't have a lot of space for it. But, of course, you know, red twig dogwoods give you the same beautiful bark effect as well.
What was the name of that, the one you just mentioned that you cut back?
Right. It's coral bark willow, Salix, which is the genus of all willows. And the cultivar is Britzensis, Britzensis.
Great. I'll come over and look at that.
All right.
Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Thanks a lot for calling, Mary. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. Maybe you have a question for our guest today, Jeff Epping of Olbrich Botanical Gardens, talking with him about a whole variety of things, planning for a good winter scape and using ornamentals to do that. So we're zeroing in a little bit on ornamentals today with him. 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mehler Show. You are a fan, and I'm really a fan of ornamental grasses too, but what makes a grass ornamental?
That's a good question, because there's a lot of grasses out there. Some are ornamental and some are not so much. One of the things that I look at first and foremost is that it not be a weedy species or an invasive species that you're going to have a problem with, you know, it seeding around in your garden and out into the environment. Or it's a runner, which is tough to control in your garden. So we most often use clump-forming grasses. Things like Panicum or the Panicum virgatum are our native switchgrass. Miscanthus, there's a lot of good cultivars of that. So we want plants that hold up well. Most of them, not all, bloom towards the fall and give us great fall interest. And, you know, most of them go through the winter and give us that interest. And that's what's, you know, really hard for northern gardeners to accomplish is a garden that's beautiful year-round. The dormant season is a long season here. Rather than put your blinders on and not want to look at your garden, you know, I like to embrace it and add interest. And it, you know, you can go beyond the grasses too. Obviously, there's lots of beautiful shrubs, trees with interesting form, beautiful bark, whether it be colorful or flaking off, like a three-flowered maple or a birch. You know, those are some of the favorites. Colored bark, like the red twig dogwoods, which we mentioned, some of the willows. Fruit, you know, a lot of the viburnums have beautiful fruit going through the winter months. Our ornamental crab apples are some of the best ornamental trees in the winter. And then going beyond plants, you know, there's the hardscape, which we, you know, was often called. So arbors and pergolas, fencing, even garden furniture. You know, I always think it's a missed opportunity when I see this, you know, sort of plastic garden furniture out in the landscape, you know, when there's such beautiful wooden chairs and benches and things like that that can stay out in the garden all year round and be beautiful, even if you know you don't
sit in
them.
Little snow on them, they look beautiful.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. And beyond that, then you know you can do winter containers. I think we're all we all want to have beautiful summer containers.
Yeah.
But you can do some great stuff with evergreens and some of those ornamental bark and fruit and such in those winter containers. In fact, we have a class coming up at Olbrich where we
put
them together. Yeah. Yeah. You know, if there's anything I talk about and I don't mention the times or dates, hit our website because that's the best place to get all the information, our full class schedules on there, all our special events, all those good things.
Absolutely. And we actually have, we've got your website up on my Facebook page too, so people can just click on it. Perfect. If you're over at the Larry Mueller Show, look up the Organic Olbrich Botanical Gardens site. So we'll link you right to it. And we have, we should go back to the phones here. John in Moose Lake, Minnesota. Your turn. Hi, John.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
So I have a question for you. There's an ornamental that grows wild. I think it's wild in my yard. I never planted it. It has the resemblance of a maple leaf, and it makes red berries in clusters. And I can't find out from anyone around who knows what that bush might be.
I would guess it would be Viburnum trilobum, which is our native high bush cranberry bush viburnum. It's called cranberry bush viburnum. It's a native plant in the upper Midwest. So check that out on the web. Go to the images or something and look, put in Viburnum trilobum,
T-R-I-L-O-B-U-M.
Right, and that had there's other viburnums that are similar too that would be native, but that would probably be my best guess.
Yeah, it makes these little clusters of red berries. They're really pretty, you know, and they hang in clusters of red berries. They look like a mini cherry, you know.
Absolutely, yeah. I bet that's what we're talking about. Beautiful plant.
Yes, yes, they're very pretty, and I can't. Nobody knows seems to know what it is. So okay, Viburnum
trilobum.
Trilobum.
L-O-B-U-M-T-R-I-L-O-B-U-M.
There you go.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks, welcome. John. Gary in Boscobel, we're on to you now. Hi, Gary. Thank you for calling.
You're welcome, Larry. I wanted to mention that I have a little fall ritual. I'm not using horticultural plants, but native plants. I do a lot of prairie restoration, and a lot of the species that are invasive to prairies, like sumac and red cedar, and some of those other woody shrubs are real troublesome on our prairies, but I cut them off, and I take them home in this time of the year, and I trim off some of the lower branches on things like the eastern juniper and put them in the ground around my bird feeders, sink them in 8 or 10 inches deep so they freeze in the ground, and I can decorate a couple of hundred square feet with this stuff, and I even use things like dry goldenrod stalks, carrion flower vines with the purple fruit on them. All these things all regrow come spring, so they're all dormant now, so I really don't do any damage. But even using black raspberry canes and things like that and just decorate a large area in the yard around the bird feeder, and the birds just love it. The ground-feeding birds go in there. I throw the cracked corn and down under the cedars, and anybody who likes to take wildlife photography can take pictures, and it looks like you're out in an old abandoned meadow someplace with shrubbery and forbs and stuff growing up. So it's really kind of a neat thing to do. So you can move a beautiful setting like that right to in front of your window if you got a little creativity.
You know, Gary, you should take a photo of that and post it on our Facebook page. I would love to see that.
Well, if I had a computer, I would, Larry.
No computer. Well, have you got a digital camera?
I do, yes.
Well, you could always take the digital picture and post it through the library.
I might just give that some thought, Larry, yes.
I'd love to see that. Actually, it sounds delightful, doesn't it?
It does. I think that's a great idea. And oftentimes, in the fall or even a little bit later, people start pruning junipers mm-hmm. and yews and all those things, which usually, you know, is recommended more for spring. But I drive up and down the curb, Larry, and I pick those up. And that's what I use in my pots and such. And he mentioned the red cedar. I always take my Christmas tree down and put it out in my yard. Yep. And literally sort of plant it for the season. And because of the cold weather, it stays green all through the winter. And come spring, then I bring it to the compost site. But that is a really great way to add interest, especially if you have a lot of hard surface like a patio or a deck. If you have a weatherproof container, I have some glaze pots, take the soil out of them, or some of these, fiberglass pots or foam injected, which can hold up to the weather. I usually stuff those with chicken wire. Just kind of ball it up. And then you can, stick ornamental grasses or twigs or anything into those to make an arrangement. They all hold in place nicely.
That's a great idea. Use chicken wire.
Yeah. And we put a few bricks down at the bottom of it, kind of tangle it up in so it has a little weight to it. And it makes the perfect substrate to have, to hold all those things in place. For years, we fooled around with leaving the soil in and trying to put them in and then pouring water, and then supposedly it would freeze, and it never works. It never works. They all fall apart. So we came up with this method, and it works perfectly.
Oh, man. Good ideas from Jeff Epping, Director of Horticulture at Olbrich Botanical Gardens. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking about planning for a good winterscape with ornamentals on this edition of Garden Talk with our guest, Jeff Epping, Director of Horticulture at Olbrich Botanical Gardens in Madison. Thanks for listening in. All our lines are filled right now. The number is 1-800-642-1234, but you can email us at talk@wpr.org or go to our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. You can post there. Frankly, there are already several really cool photographs up there. Mm-hmm. Jeff, what do we got here?
Some beautiful epimediums I see, some in flower, some in fall color.
Yeah.
They are a gorgeous plant. Great for shady location.
Oh, yeah.
Not much for winter interest, I must admit, but beautiful in the spring and summer.
Beautiful plants from Phil. Thank you, Phil. And you can take a look at them yourself if you go to our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. Robert and Nina, we have you next. Hi, Robert.
Hey, hi, Jeff and Larry. I have a question. I recently went over to Rochester, Minnesota for my class reunion, and on the way back I stopped at a wayside rest and picked up some chestnuts. And since I live on Chestnut Street in Neenah, Wisconsin, I'm kind of wondering, can I plant these things?
You can. Actually, now's the perfect time to plant them. They're much like an oaks. We plant fall plants. So you put them, an inch or two under the soil. But the one thing you're going to have to do for sure is to protect them from digging squirrels and chipmunks and that sort of thing. It's getting a little later in the season. It might not be as big an issue. But what will happen is those will send a root down, maybe even yet this fall. Some of the oaks put the root down in the fall. And then the spring, they shoot upward with a new shoot. So I would probably put a sort of a chicken wire cage or something like that around the area that you're going to plant them in, not only for now so they don't get dug up, but when the spring, when that shoot comes up, that something doesn't come through and nip that off on you. But absolutely, you can do that. I would, to hedge my bet a little, I might plant them in groups of three or something like that if you have a whole bunch of them. That way you should get at least one coming up in each one of those groups. And then if more come up, you can either transplant them next spring or just sacrifice one and keep the healthiest one going. But you
great.
Bet.
That's yeah. Great. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks a lot for calling. Mary in Whitewater, on to you now. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I wish I had space to plant some chestnuts, but I don't. my question is about some non-native plantings. My landscaping is about 50% native understory and some large trees, and then about 50% cultivars. Mm-hmm. And I avoid invasives and non-natives like a plague. But my neighbor has pampas grass, and some tiger-striped grasses, and they're very beautiful in the winter. But her pampas grass sometimes spreads onto my property. It's not easy. I mean, it's easy for me to get rid of it, but it also has moved out into a field behind us. And I went out and clipped the tops off just to keep it from spreading further by seed because it was too dry to pick it up from the root. And so that's my one question about invasives. My other question is that I purchased a cultivated version of Japanese honeysuckle called Hall's Improved Japanese Honeysuckle. And my guess, I thought that maybe it was improved because it was not invasive.
Mm-hmm.
And when I grew up on the East Coast, we had the vine honeysuckle. It would grow out in the fields, and mm-hmm. It was very tasty to pick and suck on. And I haven't seen it here in Wisconsin. It's probably here. I'm just familiar with that other invasive brush type. So I was wondering, if this is an invasive Japanese honeysuckle, how are the plant stores allowed to sell these?
Right. Well, I know the DNR has been working a lot on invasive species, and actually I would hit their website and check out the list of plants that they have on there.
Well, they do have a Japanese honeysuckle, but mm-hmm. This particular one, it has a Latin name, and it says Hall's Improved. And I don't think that's the one they have on their website. So I'm wondering is, how are these, you know, are these getting through to the mass market because they're okay?
Well, you know, there's a lot of politics involved with that whole situation. I don't claim to be an expert on it. And like I say, I think I would just hit their website, check out what they have to say, check out their list. It's often they'll list the particular species, but they don't list all the various cultivars of it.
Uh-huh.
Some of those cultivars could be sterile, possibly.
Uh-huh.
Others, not so much. So it's really a very complex situation that's going on there, and I don't claim to know all the ins and outs of it. But we do avoid many of the plants that are on that list. Interestingly, I was contacted by the folks who work on that project a few years back and said, you know, what would you like me to remove from the botanic garden?
Mm-hmm.
And they told me, don't remove anything yet because, you know, we need some of those plants out so the public can see them. We want them properly mm-hmm. identified, listed, that they are invasive species. And we may want you, you know, to be working with that, you know, aspect of it, because
sure.
You put a name out and people don't know one, you know, one from the other necessarily, and so they need to see those plants.
What about the pampas grass?
Well, the pampas grass, that's probably a species of Miscanthus called Miscanthus transmorisonensis, which is a incredibly invasive spreader.
Mm-hmm.
That plant is not sold. I've never seen it for sale in a nursery. But it's one of those plants that you see if you drive out in the country. You'll see in an old farmstead or something, and there's an enormous clump, and it keeps getting bigger and bigger. People divide those, give it to their neighbor, and that's really how it's spreading more than anything.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that it is that serious of a seed propagated plant, but it certainly is a severe runner. So that's like when I mentioned earlier about ornamental grass. That's the first thing we look at when we when we look for new plants to incorporate into the garden. Is there are they spreading by seed or runners?
Mm-hmm.
And if so, then we pass on those. There's so many good plants out there to use that
why?
We don't need to.
Yeah,
we really don't need to. Yeah, and you know, there is sort of a misnomer about plants being invasive. I mean, the previous caller said, "Oh, you know, I have invasive species that are in my prairie: red cedar and sumac." Well, those are two native plants, aren't they? And so to say that every plant that's not native here is a weed and invasive, and every native plant is not, is not necessarily true. So we really have to look at all these plants, evaluate them, and it's the job of botanic gardens, arboreta, to test some of those plants and see, and then weed out those that would be potential problems.
Well, I don't want to be responsible for birds picking these seeds off this Japanese honeysuckle and spreading them all over the state.
Mm-hmm. No, right.
Right. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yep. You're thanks, welcome. Mary. And Pat in Madison, we're on to you now. Hi, Pat. Thank you very much for calling.
Good morning. Thanks for having me. I have more of a winter question, I guess, than a winter scape question. And I'm a totally Darwinian gardener who knows very little, except when I see things I love. And in Connecticut, I've always loved laurel plants, and I love their blooms. But I have a space now in my yard that's been a slate patio, and it's in a sort of a protected southeast corner with a rock wall. And I've gotten wisteria to be happy there. Mm-hmm. And I wondered if I were to plant laurel in amongst the slate tiles, if that might create a warm enough or protected enough space that I could get those beautiful, beautiful flowers.
Mm-hmm. Are you speaking of cherry laurel? Is it a shrub? Is that what you're?
Yeah, it's a shrub, yeah. And they have sort of waxy, cup-like clusters of flowers in tons of different colors.
Right. Unfortunately, that plant is not hardy for us here in the upper Midwest. Coming from Connecticut, you were in another horticultural world over there, one that I wish we had a little here, especially at this time of year. But cherry laurel, like many of the broadleaf evergreens, have a really tough time in our climate, and that's because our winters are so severe. Any evergreen, whether it be a broadleaf evergreen or conifer, can lose moisture or do lose moisture all year long, including the winter. Well, here in Madison or in Wisconsin, our soils freeze solid down, a few feet maybe. And those roots are frozen, cannot take up any water, but yet the moisture can be lost from the foliage. And so many of the conifers, especially the native ones, have learned to adapt with that and seem to be okay. But the broadleaf evergreens are another story. They really have a tough time. And so even growing something like rhododendrons for us, pretty tough to put them out in the open. Eastern or northern exposure, especially northern, would be the best for us. And people think, well, that's the coldest. Well, you know what? You're right. It is. It freezes and stays frozen, and that includes the foliage as well as the soil. Mm-hmm. And they're out of the sun. They're in complete shade all the time, so the transpiration loss is cut down. And so if you're going to have a fighting chance, those are the locations that you want to try with a broadleaf evergreen that's sort of on the edge hardiness-wise. We have gotten by a little bit with some of the hollies in that regard, and like I said, the rhododendrons and some of the other tender broadleaf evergreens. But, in a real severe winter, they'll suffer even in those locations. As a northern gardener, you always want to try something that you shouldn't be, and that's half the fun of gardening, So if you can get it to live for 3 years, you think, hey, I did that. And you don't tell anybody it died on you. You just tell them you used to grow it, But that's kind of the story with cherry laurel and a lot of those guys. And then the other side of that is a lot of those same broadleaf evergreens love acid soils, which at least in the Madison area, we have very few locations that have that. We have very high pH. So then you got to fight that battle, too.
There you go.
So sad. Thank you.
All right. Sorry.
Thanks, Matt, for calling. Barry and Trempolo, your turn. Hi. Thank you for calling.
Yes. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Jeff, I have a question about spreading yews, which I think is a very, very lovely winter color for if you want color. We have a lot of evergreens out here in Trempolo. But getting to my question here, Jeff, I put spreading yews along the foundation of the house. Mm-hmm. And I want to save those, but I have a wood foundation house. Now, the root system on them, are they spreading like the top layer of the evergreens? Is that a concern, or should I just let it go?
So you're talking, you're interested in transplanting them, and that's why you're interested in knowing the root system, or are you worried about, okay.
That's correct, yes. I'd like to transplant them in the back if the roots should be a problem.
Sure. Well, the roots on any plant are going to spread, as far as they can. How old they are, how old they are is how far they spread oftentimes, but in the type of soil. In a heavier soil, the roots probably won't spread as far as in lighter soils. But With that said, most roots are going to be in that top 12 to 18 inches of soil, even in large trees. If you ever see a large maple or oak blow over in a windstorm, what do you see? You see this large pancake peel up of soil, because that's where all, you know, most of the roots are. Why? Because that's where the oxygen and gas exchanges, that's where the nutrients are from all the organic matter breaking down, that's where the moisture is from rainfall. And so that old fallacy about, you know, the root system goes down as deep as the tree is high is just that. It's not true. So in your case, you know, I'd say, I don't know how old the plants are or how big around they are necessarily, but I always say the bigger the root system you can get, the better. Not necessarily go very deep. I mean, even going down 12 to 18 inches, get as big as you can handle. And transplanting, especially an evergreen or conifer like that, you want to do that in the spring, not the fall, because remember, they're going to lose moisture. You know, you cut the root system in the fall, they're subject to desiccation anyway, and now you just reduced, you know, a lot of the potential to take up moisture. Mm-hmm. What I would do, if you're going to plant them, transplant them next spring, water them really well now, and that's true with everybody out there. If you have had a droughty summer like we have had here in Madison, very good idea to deeply water your evergreens a couple times yet this season. Still have plenty of time to do that before the soil freezes, so that those plants are very well hydrated going through the winter, and they'll be less apt to burn. And in your case, your plant will be easier to transplant next spring. Mm-hmm. So get, you know, bigger root system as you can, you know, just transplant it immediately. Get it, you know, settled in, water it very deeply and well to, you know, force out any air around the root system and get them in good, and then mulch to keep that moisture evenly, you know, moist in there, and that'll be your best bet.
The yews are in a very confined area. I would say probably about 3 feet from the foundation to the sidewalk, and they're about 4 years old, and they've just outgrown the area, and I'm always constantly, twice a summer at least, trimming off by the sidewalk area.
Yeah,
right.
So they are spreading.
Okay. Well, it sounds like you should have pretty good luck with them if they're, you know, only 4 years old.
Good luck. Thank you, Barry, for calling. Appreciate it very much. Bill in Madison, we're going to turn to you next. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Larry.
Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
I needed some help trying to identify an ornamental grass.
Okay.
It's about 6 foot tall, very large clumps, and it looked like a male pheasant's tail where it was banded.
It possibly is Indian grass or Sargassum nutans, which is one of our native prairie species. It does get taller, you know, anywhere from 5 to probably 8 feet, depending on the soil and moisture and all that sort of thing. But it has the seed heads are in, tufts like that, versus, you know, the other grasses that I'm thinking of that height really don't have that characteristic. So I'm guessing that's it, but without, you know, it's tough.
Yeah, without
seeing a picture, it's pretty tough.
Okay.
Thanks a lot for calling. If you have a photo, put it up on our Facebook page and we'll see if we can identify it.
Sounds good.
All right. Thanks for calling. And that goes for anyone else as well. If you have a plant that you're trying to identify and don't know it, if you've got a photo, send it to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page and we'll see what we can do. You can call in with your questions as well, by the way, at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call. We have open lines. We'll get you on pretty quickly. Chris in Green Bay up next. Let's go there. Hi, Chris.
Hi, guys. I've got a problem with goldenrod taking over a portion of the prairie that I have in my backyard. Is that going to require hand pulling each one or going after it with Roundup? I need to get, it's taken over, in other words.
Right. Many of the goldenrods are very happy here, and they do colonize. More than likely, it's one of the native ones, maybe Solidago rugosa. There's a lot of different species out there, but most of them do exactly what you're talking of. You know, it depends on your mindset. Some people are willing to use an herbicide every now and then to try to keep something under control like that. Others are not. You could right now cut it down to the ground and cover that area with black plastic, or some people use old carpet or whatever, so that when that plant tries to come up in spring, you're excluding light from it and some moisture. And that would be a way to, you know, start to slow it down at least. Then, you know, maybe remove that, say, come June or July, see what's left under there. Maybe do a little digging at that point. Or, you know, if you're going to use an herbicide, it needs to be in an actively growing state. So you wouldn't do that until next spring, and something like Roundup or glyphosate would be what you'd probably be using.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks very much for calling. And an email from Phil, who says, I have a hibiscus plant, the kind that can stay planted outside all winter with the huge blossoms, and there are seeds in the dried-up flower stalks.
Mm-hmm.
Can I save these seeds and plant them to start some new plants? If so, how do I do that?
Okay, well, the plant in question is one called Rose of Sharon, which is Hibiscus syriacus. And that is definitely a woody hibiscus. We also have a herbaceous hibiscus that, you know, just comes up from the ground each season, which is equally as beautiful. Yes, you could propagate it from seed. Off the top of my head, I don't know the exact requirements, but most of those woody plants, what you do is put them into what they call stratification, moist stratification. So you take those dried seeds, put them in a moist peat moss or sand. When I say moist, you want moisture in there, but you don't want free moisture. So you don't want mold and such growing, but you want to basically mimic the conditions that those seeds would have in the soil if they would fall to the ground right now. So we have this freezing and thawing and cold, moist situation all winter. And then after, you know, that period of time, the seed inhibitors are all broken down, and then the seed will germinate. So what you do is put them in that, like I say, sand or peat moss, throw it in a refrigerator for about 3 months, take them out, sow them, and you should get germination. One thing to realize, though, is that you will more than likely not get the big flowers that you have on that original plant, because there's genetic variation in those seeds.
They don't breed true.
Right. So if you want the exact plant, then you'd have to do what we call asexual propagation. You have to do a cutting of that plant, and that's generally what they do in the nursery industry, so that they can guarantee that you get the exact same aesthetic qualities on the plants that they're producing. So that's the downside, or maybe the upside. If you want to try and see what comes up, you might get different colored flowers, different shapes. Never know.
Jeff Epping, Director of Horticulture at Old Break, Director of Horticulture at Old Break Botanical Gardens in Madison. Larry Mueller here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking about planning for a good winterscape with ornamentals, our guest today, Jeff Epping, Director of Horticulture at Old Break Botanical Gardens in Madison. Thank you for listening in. Really appreciate your calls at 1-800-642-1234 or your emails at talk@wpr.org. Or going to our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. You can do that as well and post some photos or questions there. And, you know, thinking about the garden in the wintertime, one of the areas that we didn't talk about, we could talk about, I think, a little, is garden art and stone and things of that nature.
Absolutely. You know, those are things that look good at all times of the year, but
right,
especially come to prominence during the winter months, because the plants around them are all sort of, you know, the same tone maybe and all. And metal art or stone art, or even stone boulders and such in the landscape. Some people call it the bones of the landscape, along with, you know, all those other things we mentioned, arbors, pergolas, attractive fencing, garden, furniture. Even your walkways and such, mm-hmm. you know, concrete's, you know, easy and cheap, you know, relatively so, but there's lots of great pavers out there, and mixing some of the man-made pavers, maybe a brick or such, along with some natural stone, stone fences or walls, short walls, either they be natural stone or, again, the pre-made kind that are of varying degrees of aesthetically pleasing nature, I guess. Some are very much, you know, to do the job, and others are a little more ornamental. All those things, you know, play into adding interest to your garden in the winter.
We have Janice from Arborvita up next. Hi, Janice.
Good morning. I'm listening to your program, and I guess I would apply this to other programs as well. When you live way up in northern Wisconsin, and I would love to have some ornamentals in my yard, but it would be nice if you would include information on zone hardiness and deer resistance. That's one of my biggest problems, is deer resistance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's true in a lot of areas of the state. Deer are just a...
They are tough, you know, and that's what I tell people. If you really want to guarantee that your plants are not eaten or your garden is not eaten, the only really true way is to put up a deer fence. And that doesn't mean a little picket fence. That means 10 foot high
that.
Or whatever. Yeah. I know a gardener near where I grew up, near Kenosha or Lake Geneva, and they had a wooded lot. And they used this, it was actually a plastic fencing that was, I think, about 8 or 10 feet tall. It was a lot less expensive than, of course, mm-hmm. you know, the they just ran it sort of from tree to tree. They didn't do the entire garden, but they did an area where they really wanted to garden intensively and have their vegetable garden and really protect it. The beauty of that fence, not only is it was less expensive, but it was almost invisible, especially from a distance, because it wasn't super heavy.
Yeah.
And the deer still had room to roam in the rest of their woods. But as far as, you know, trying to select specific plants, you know, some are definitely not palatable to deer, but so many will be fine for a year or two or three, and then we get really heavy deer pressure, be it from the weather, you know, heavy snow cover, whatever, and they'll eat just about anything in sight. So it's, and I'll be honest with you, at Olbrich, we do not have a deer problem. And so I can't speak of that like someone else who Larry would have on would, you know, be more familiar with it. So, you know, I understand your frustration, but, you know, if I can read a blog just as well as anybody and, you know, and tell you what they tell me or what they say about what is eaten and what isn't. But from personal experience, I really can't tell you.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks. We can mention zones from, you know, where they're hardy and so forth. Mm-hmm. So we'll certainly do that. Peter in Milwaukee, on to you. Hi, Peter.
Hello. I have a question about soil. I had purchased and put 3 bags of earthworm castings in my garden.
Mm-hmm.
Since then, I've noticed the plants are very stunted. Very, very stunted. They would be considered bonsai.
Really? That would be just the opposite of what I would imagine.
That was the opposite of what I was expecting.
Now, was there anything else? Did you apply them directly over soil, or did you put them over a mulch maybe that you had existing previously?
I pulled the mulch aside and put the earthworm castings pretty much in the top layer of the soil.
Yeah, because, you know, oftentimes, I would say if you were left, say, a wood mulch in place there and put earthworm castings over the top, there may be some issue with the soil microbes then trying to break down that wood mulch and using some of the nutrients in the soil to do so and starving the plants a little bit. But, wow, that's a tough one. I don't know what to tell you. I'm not an expert on soil fertility, but certainly worm castings are a great thing to use, you know, good organic material out there. And we've done a little bit of that at the garden, and we've had great results. And just the opposite of what you're describing. Were they new plants, or is it plants that have been around for a while?
No, these are vegetables.
Vegetables.
Zucchini, tomatoes, cucumbers. Mm-hmm. I was wondering, perhaps I could have the soil tested for some foreign matter.
You could have it tested for an herbicide or something that may have gotten, maybe there was some sort of herbicide in the casting somehow. Or maybe you just had a kind of a bad, I mean, there were some gardens that didn't do too well this last year, vegetable gardens, and it, you know, it was areas where the moisture wasn't good or was sporadic.
Unfortunately, this is the second season.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Sometimes, too, you know, if you put on a heavier, I mean, I don't know if you were irrigating or not, but this holds true with mulch. You know, in a dry season, the mulch can almost be worse if you don't irrigate, because say you have 3-4 inches of mulch and you get a few light rains that may help you if you didn't have that mulch, are now getting tied up in that mulch and the roots are unavailable to the roots. And I'm wondering with you maybe too, if that those worm castings were very thick, if that may have excluded some of the rainfall. But I know in Madison, it was a dry season, and I had to irrigate my zucchini and such, and they had a banner year, I'll be honest. I couldn't give enough away.
That's good. And I think this is the only variable that is different.
Yeah. I would, you know, you can get it tested.
Yeah, well, that's always a good idea anyway, yeah. I think, is, you know, if, it's well worth the investment to have a soil test done to see what's going on in all regards, how much organic matter you have in the soil, what your fertility is. They'll give you exact recommendations on what you should add to your soil to make it ideal. And, of course, that's huge for any plant. If it's on good soil, that's half the battle.
Thanks for calling, Peter. Appreciate your call. We had an email from Luann in La Crescent, Minnesota, who said, we planted Jack Forrester ornamental grass in May of this year. Should we cut it back? If yes, when is the best time to cut it back, or and how short should we cut it?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. And the plant you're speaking of is one called Calamagrostis. And actually, it's Carl Forrester, unless Jack is his evil brother or something. but the cultivar is called Carl, K-A-R-L. It's a cultivar out of Germany, actually, if I'm not mistaken. It's a great grass for us, and it is one that does bloom in the summer. So that extends the season. But it still looks good now. And I would say with 99% of the ornamental grasses out there, we leave them up all winter long. Because remember, we want that winter interest.
Yeah.
So leave them up if they look good. Cut them back in the spring. And we usually cut them to about 2 inches, 3 inches or so is enough. But on Carl Forrester, because it is a cooler season grass, you want to get out there right away. Because if it starts to grow and the new foliage is coming up through the old stuff, it's really difficult to cut that old off without damaging the new. Where many, say the miscanthus and many of the prairie grasses are warm season grasses, you have plenty of time in the spring to cut them back before you have that happen.
We have more callers. Ken in Walworth has a question for you. Hi, Ken.
Oh, good morning, Larry and Jeff.
Morning.
I have a small lilac bush out and back. I got it from the Arbor Day Foundation. And anyway, I'm where I live is being sold, so I have to move between now and next spring. And I'm wondering, can I take that with me? Can I dig it up, put it in a big pot, or what would I have to do?
So it sounds like you don't have the option to move it into a new site. You have to hold it for a while. Is that true?
Right. I don't know. I haven't found a place that I want to buy exactly just yet. So I don't know when and where exactly I'm going to be moving.
Okay. Well, what you want? The good thing is the common lilacs, or most of the lilacs in general, are very tough plants, and so they transplant better than most. So I guess what I would do is, now that it's dormant, or it's, even now, even if it's has a few leaves hanging on, it's basically going dormant. Dig it up, put it in a pot that will hold it. I'm assuming it's fairly large. So, you know, do what you can to get it in a pot. Make sure you get all the air pockets out of there. Water it in. And then for the winter, I would put it again if you have a location, shady location, north side of a house would be best, or garage, or a group of evergreen trees or something. Put it there. Either dig a hole for it and plant the pot right in the soil, or if you leave it above ground, wood chip it in. Get some mulch, wood chip it in. And why do we do that? Because the root systems of any plant are way more sensitive to cold than the tops. You know, they've been adapted to grow in soil. Well, even if the soil freezes, it doesn't get much below 25 degrees or 20 degrees or so. Yeah. But above ground, it can get to minus 20, and that's what will kill them. And so just protect that root system. The top of the plant will be fine. And then as soon as you can plant it next spring, do so.
Mm-hmm. Would it be all right like in a garage, did you say?
Well, if you put it in a garage, you still want to protect that root system. You would put it right on the floor, and you would create a mulch sort of mound around it, and you could do that whatever way you feel, you know, it's good.
Okay.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
That would probably be fine.
All right. Well, thanks very much.
You're thanks welcome. Very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Someone wondered if ornamental grasses are always perennials. Not, are they?
No, there are some beautiful annual ornamental grasses. Many of you are probably familiar with the purple fountain grass. Beautiful burgundy foliage, great nodding seed heads. It gets up to about 3, 4, 5 feet tall. There's now some dwarf varieties of that. There's other beautiful sedges. One's called the New Zealand sedge or brown sedge. So there's some nice annuals out there too. So yeah, when you buy those at the greenhouse in the spring, you'll want to pay attention to that because some of them are zoned 7, 8, or 9 plants, and you're not going to have them beyond.
Not going to work here.
No, they'll be beautiful for the season. So you know, I think we have this thought that if it isn't a flowering plant. Yeah. As it being an annual, it's no good. Well, that's not true. I mean, some of the annual grasses are absolutely beautiful in combination with other foliage plants and flowers in our pots and at home.
Jeff Epping is the director of horticulture at Olbrich Botanical Gardens in Madison and our guest here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. A well-planned garden is a real joy to behold, but What makes for a great landscape? What kinds of plants should we combine for the most interesting foliage and flower combinations that are going to last as long as possible? Hi, Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you along today for another edition of Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Jeff Epping, Director of Horticulture at Olbrich Botanical Gardens in Madison, our guest until 12:30 today. He has lots of great tips to offer from this year's garden management experiences, and he's happy to answer your questions when you call us at 1-800-642-1234, or you email us at talk@wpr.org. And don't forget to check our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. If you like the page while you're there, you'll get regular updates on upcoming show topics, and I hope you'll stay tuned because we'll be back right after this look at the news. Stay with us on the Ideas Network.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Investors are closely watching what transpires in Greece, where Prime Minister George Papandreou faces a crucial vote of confidence in Parliament that could bring down his government and determine whether a massive Eurozone bailout plan reached last week will become a reality. Papandreou says he wants to discuss a possible caretaker government with opposition politicians, but as Joanna Kakisis reports from Athens, they only want snap elections.
The main opposition leader, Andonis Samaras, who leads the conservative New Democracy Party, called Papandreou a liar and a traitor and said he had no intention of negotiating with him. Elections now, Samaras said. That way, he said, people can escape this climate of fear and blackmail that the government has created in the last year and a half. Papandreou's socialist PASOK party would not win new elections, since most polls show it's garnering just 20% support. But voters also have little faith in Samaras and New Democracy. For NPR News, I'm Joanna Kakissis in Athens.
Investors are also eyeing today's U.S. jobs report, which was mixed. Fewer positions were added to payrolls last month compared with September. But the unemployment rate has dropped, though slightly, to 9%. Analyst Hugh Johnson says economic growth is falling victim to various factors.
Clearly, this economy is struggling, or it's being held in check by housing problems in Europe, problems that affected us from Japan and the rise in oil prices. A lot of sort of headwinds have affected the economy and slowed the growth of employment, so it's not doing what it ordinarily would do in an economic recovery.
At last check on Wall Street, the Dow is down 145 points or more than 1% at 11,899. NASDAQ was off nearly 1% at 2673. Former New Jersey Governor John Corzine has resigned as head of the securities firm MF Global. NPR's Mike Pesca reports that Corzine will decline the $12 million severance package to which he is
legally entitled.
Corzine, who used the fortune he amassed as CEO of Goldman Sachs to fund his run for senator and then governor of New Jersey, wanted to turn MF Global into a bigger Wall Street player. To that end, he oversaw his new firm's aggressive positions on foreign debt, positions which began to look shakier as the global financial crisis grew. Days ago, MF Global declared bankruptcy, and federal regulators are investigating over $600 million that are still missing from investor funds. Corzine, a critic of Wall Street excess as a public servant, came in for criticism himself for allowing his firm to be highly leveraged, essentially a replay of the financial crisis of 2008. Mike Pesca, NPR News, New York.
This is NPR. Jury deliberation is underway in the involuntary manslaughter trial of Michael Jackson's personal doctor. 6 weeks after the start of the case, prosecutors characterized Dr. Conrad Murray as an inept physician solely to blame for administering the anesthetic propofol, which was cited as the cause of the pop icon's death in 2009. But Murray's defense argues Jackson gave himself the fatal dose of the powerful anesthetic when Murray was not present. British Airways is buying rival airline BMI from Lufthansa. Larry Miller reports the competition is concerned the acquisition gives BA too great a hold on the United Kingdom's commercial aviation.
The deal would see BA buying BMI, formerly known as British Midland, for around $500 million. If approved by the regulators, BA's share of Heathrow's takeoff and landing slots would increase from 45% to 53%. Rival airline Virgin Atlantic wanted BMI as well. It warns the deal is anti-competitive. Virgin Atlantic claims BA's hold over Heathrow is already too dominant and its purchase of BMI would be disastrous for consumer choice. BA's parent company announced the deal at the same time as its financial results that showed pre-tax profit increased fivefold in the first 9 months of this year, while total revenue hit $20 billion. For NPR News, I'm Larry Miller in London.
U.S. stocks continue to fall, with the Dow down 147 points or 1.2% at 11,899, and the NASDAQ is down nearly 1%. It's at 2673. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, supporting this year's community health leaders, working to improve health in communities nationwide at communityhealthleaders.org.
Support for WPR comes from Focus on Energy, committed to providing energy-saving solutions, including the use of compact fluorescent bulbs designed to produce warm, even light. Learn more at lightupwisconsin.com.
Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Miller here, talking on this edition of Garden Talk about planning for a good winterscape with ornamentals. Jeff Epping, Director of Horticulture at Olbrich Botanical Gardens in Madison, our guest, and you can join in if you have a question. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email at talk@WPR.org. Go to our Facebook page at the Larry Miller Show. You can also post a comment there or a photo. Mary in Partyville, you are up. Hi, Mary.
Hi. Hello. Appreciate your show a lot.
Thank you.
I have a long 75-foot line of like large decorative stone. And last year, this midnight primrose grew out of it, these long sprouts with yellow flowers on the end.
Mm-hmm.
And we love it. And I'm wondering if I should cut it back before the winter so I can keep it going. I just don't know how it just sprouted out all by itself.
Right, right. I'm guessing some seeds probably moved in from nearby and got started. Most of the evening primroses, Oenothera is the genus, O-E-N-E, or T-H-E-R-A. Mm-hmm. So it's a perennial.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, if you like the look of it, you could leave it up through the winter and cut it back in the spring. If you'd rather sort of clean it up and see the wall more prominently, you could do so now. So
I like the look of it, so I'll leave it. And yeah. A butterfly bushes. How do I get fuller butterfly bushes? I have five of them.
Well, butterfly bush for us here in Madison, if you can get about 3 years out of them, you're probably doing good.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
they
right.
really are a true shrub. almost small tree-like if you go down south where they're completely hardy. For us, we treat them as what we call a dieback shrub, where we cut them to the ground every spring.
Oh, you do?
Yep. And if you want to help them to last longer, mulch them in like you would a hybrid tea rose or something. So you could put an extra sort of cone of soil over them with some mulch or marsh hay or something like that.
Do I cut them back now?
I would... You can cut them back now if you wish. It basically, they're going to die back no matter what. Yeah, I've never seen one live beyond the soil line or maybe the snow line. But they come back, with full force. In fact, we always have them in the garden because they grow so prolifically. And even if you got 1 year out of them, they would still be.
Well, I'm growing them in sand, and I'm really amazed.
That's good. Yeah, they're very drought-tolerant plants, so they're very happy in that situation.
Well, I like it that they get the butterflies,
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. They're beautiful.
But what do I plant there in its place after they're gone? Just plant another one.
Yeah, keep it going, Mary.
Five more.
That's right. Keep that nursery industry alive.
All right.
Times are tough.
Thanks a lot for calling. Rebecca in Platteville, your turn. Hi, Rebecca.
Through laziness and lack of opportunity, I have a pound of wildflower mixed seed, which never got scattered. It's been kept in the refrigerator. Is it too late? It's a combination of perennial and annual. There's some coneflower, different kinds of coneflower, flax, coreopsis, something called Gallardia, something like
that. Sure, that's an annual.
Shasta's, black-eyed Susan's.
Yep. I would think what you'd want to do is if you put them on the ground now. It's so cold now. They're not going to germinate anymore this season. But the beauty of doing it now is that they will come up and start growing right along with the weather that they should be growing with. So you won't have that problem where you forgot about them again or get them out too late. Because oftentimes in the spring, how it is. It's wet and rainy, and you can't prepare a soil bed for them, and you have to wait. And then by that time, the spring rains kind of subside, and now you're tied to artificially irrigating them instead. So, fall seeding a lawn now, or prairie, or meadow, or any of those things is a great idea. And then they just sit dormant until all the conditions are perfect next spring and they come to life.
All right. There you go. Thank you very much for calling. We have a Facebook question from Mary Beth who says, grasses, they are unbelievably beautiful, but the only one I've had tore me to shreds when I cut it back in the spring. Do all grasses need to be cut down? When do they absolutely need to be divided? My grass got a big clump of dead material in the center, but looked full and beautiful when the new grass came up. Mm-hmm. My mom just mowed over her pampas grass year after year after year, except when she didn't, and then they seemed to be fine too. So,
some of that, that's a good point. Years ago when perennials became more sort of more popular, it's like, oh, plant perennials because, there's no maintenance. They come back every year. Well, of course, those of us who garden know that's completely false. Everything in life that is worth having requires maintenance. So dividing is something that you have to do. Cutting back is something that, you would do with ornamental grasses because having that new growth come up in the dead really looks quite nasty. The easiest way to cut them back, I think, is what I picked up at a garage sale is an old hedge trimmer, an electric one, because you could get the gas ones and all that, but they're a lot of work and maintenance too. So I just take that hedge trimmer. I first take my clump of grass, say it's 4 or 5 feet tall, bundle it together with twine or a bungee cord or whatever you have. And then when you have it kind of bound up, then you take it right at the base with that hedge trimmer, go right through it, and it has a lot of power. Get a bigger one if you can find one. Right through that thing, pick it up, take it out to the curb or your compost pile, wherever you're taking it, and you're good to go. At Old Brick, we have so many grasses. What we use is a gas-powered string trimmer, but it has a blade on it, like a steel saw blade. And you see those around landscape companies use them. And that's what we use there because there's just so many. So they can be done by hand with hand pruners, but boy, your wrist will be sore by the end of a few. I know, I've done it. As far as dividing goes, We actually use a sawzall or a reciprocating saw, you know, with the long blade on them. So we will dig them up, pop them above the ground, cut them into pieces, basically like you'd cut a pizza. You know, yeah. Just cut through, and you know they don't have to be a perfect round sphere. They grow out of that. You'll never know the difference halfway through the season. And then just replant in the same spot, or maybe you want to expand the bed or give some to your neighbors, or you know if you have a plant sale in your local community, donate them to that. You know, so yeah, they do generally need to be divided about every 3 years. And it again, it depends on the growth rate, the soil you have. The email mentioned that opening up in the winter, like a donut, in the middle, I should say, like a donut. And that's the sign when it's time to divide. When the center of the plant dies, but it's all on the outside only, divide them up. Oftentimes, too, the grasses will lodge or start to fall over. That's, you know, when they need to be divided.
And we have Barbara in Milwaukee up next. Hi, Barbara.
I have an indigo plant or bush, small one in my backyard on the east side of Milwaukee. And for years, I never cut it back during the winter. And then last spring, I noticed that it was like it was dying. Well, I got a few stalks coming back, and I wondered, do they have, you know, a period of where they last and then die, or should I cut it back in the, you know, like right now and mulch it?
Right. Well, Baptisia is a plant that we're talking about.
It has gorgeous blue flowers.
Right. Indigo plant. Yeah. And there's some beautiful new cultivars of them, too.
Their
breeding program down at the Chicago Botanical Gardens has come out with just some gorgeous plants, and they're big and lush. And, but in general, that plant is really bulletproof. So I'm shocked, that that's happened. You know, sometimes in our landscapes, you know, all conditions change slowly over time. Where we had full sun, that tree is, that much bigger, and they're getting shade. Or maybe drainage has changed for some reason. A downspout got moved.
Well, I nurtured it back, and I noticed just now that one little stalk is turning black again. So I'm going to cut that out. But is it okay to leave it up for the winter?
Generally so. I mean, when you think about plants out there in the real world, in their native habitats, nobody's ever cutting them back, right? I mean, prairie plants would have fires come through periodically, but, you know, plants just grow with that. However, if you have, you might have some fungal problem or such, I guess because of the problem you're having, I might cut them now.
That's what I was thinking.
Remove all that plant material and compost and get it away so that you will remove any of the disease organism that will come back again.
Should I mulch the root part or not?
I don't think you'd have to do that. That plant is very drought tolerant.
That's
fact,
what I was going to ask you, if maybe I didn't water it enough. But, you know, it was an unusual year because I've never in my life on the east side of Milwaukee had Japanese beetles. And I started looking at my roses because I heard about it, you know, on one of Larry's shows. And here were my beautiful pink roses covered in beetles. And, you know, and then I, of course, you know, flicked them into the ammonia water and all that sort of stuff.
Right. So that's Larry's fault, I think. You didn't have any problems until you mentioned it.
No. If I hadn't listened, I wouldn't have known what to do. You know? So bless
you. Thank
you so much.
You're welcome.
Well,
good luck.
Thanks a lot for calling. And Phil says, you know, on the Japanese beetles, he's seeing that in areas where they were really bad, usually three, four years goes by, and then they're not so bad anymore.
Right. That's what I've heard as well, and I'm looking forward to that day.
Oh, boy. Well, you know, here we're not that far from Olbrich at our home, and we had these beautiful grapevines, and which they love.
They love,
But I think I had like three. I saw three Japanese beetles.
Oh, good for you.
That was it.
Yeah.
The whole time.
Yeah. And, you know, we don't spray any chemicals for them. You know, we just ride them out. And Phil knows his stuff. So I don't doubt him. I'm just hoping it comes sooner rather than later.
Tim in Watertown, let's go to you now. Hi, Tim.
Hi there. Say, enjoy your show tremendously.
Thanks.
And, thanks for the opportunity to call in. I have a question about sedums. There's a lot of really nice low-growing sedums like dragon's blood and red carpet and caudicola and angelina, and they're really hot for using as green roofs.
Right.
What about using it between the sidewalk and the roadway for salt? Is there a salt tolerance issue with that, or is that something that might work?
Right. To be honest, I don't have a lot of personal experience with it, but most of the drought-tolerant perennials or plants are also salt-tolerant. And I would guess that your sedums will be okay. You know, it's one thing if, you know, you get a little salt spray or salt runoff from a street. It's another thing if, you know, somebody is constantly dumping salt and, you know, particles sure. get, you see that once in a while and it's like, boy, nothing can grow in that. So I would say that I'd definitely give it a try. And okay. I'll be honest with you, at the garden, we struggle with sedums in our beds because Olbrich was developed in a marsh. And so our soils are very, very high in organic rich. Matter and tend to be wetter. And that's exactly what sedums do not like. They right. like the hot, dry, droughty conditions, well-drained soils. And oftentimes that's what you see out in that parkway because you dig down and there'll be gravel, you know, underneath sure. there. If you ever see them redo a street, you know, you often see what goes on. You know, yeah. most of it's filled with gravel. They top it off with maybe 12 inches of soil and then they throw a tree in and ask it to live and prosper.
Yeah, the turf doesn't do well. So I just right. figured maybe seeding would be a good option, and it
absolutely.
Doesn't really need any water. So
absolutely, I would definitely give it a shot. There's also some great sedges and other plants that would thrive in some of those droughty conditions. And you know, when we were speaking earlier of grasses that have a running characteristic, you know, they spread by their rhizomes or root systems.
Sure.
In an open bed, that's not so good. But in a situation like you're talking about, it's perfect. Because they're tough and fast growing, they fill up the space. They're bordered by a curb and a sidewalk. They have no place to go, and then you know that's the perfect spot yeah. for them.
Absolutely,
okay, great. Thanks, guys. Please.
Yeah, thank you very much for calling. And Richard in Madison, we turn to you now. Hi, Richard.
Hi. My question is how to prune evergreens, like particularly balsams. So that they develop a nice cone-shaped holiday tree.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's not something you would do at this time of year, for sure. That's basically in June when the plants are in what they call the candle stage, when they start to send out the new growth. If you pay attention to conifers, it's very interesting. You know, they just sit there for the longest time in spring. Everything else is coming to life and yeah. growing all around them, and they're just sitting there, and people don't always notice it until they start what they call candle out, where they send those shoots out. And that's the time of year that you would prune those plants, and every time that you remove a growing tip, you allow the dormant buds along that candle to grow. And so then you get more shoots coming out rather than just one. And that's how they get Christmas trees to be so full. That's the time of year that you wanted to go ahead with it.
What length do you prune off, a third or?
I'd say you could do about, third to a half. You don't want to remove the whole thing because the growing tips on conifers are only in those candles. And if you take it off totally, then it'll die back to the next whorl of branches. And so, that's a very good point.
Good points. Good luck, Richard. Thank you very much for calling. And we have an email from Lynn, who says, we planted three holly plants, supposedly fine for our zone. We're in Wausau. Two on the northeast and one on the northwest side of our home. We were advised by the landscaper to put in stakes and wrap burlap around them to shield them from winter winds. He said not to cover the tops. Well, we lost two of them last winter, and the third was so badly damaged we replaced all three. Now we have to decide how to protect them this winter. What do you suggest?
Well, my stance on plants that you have to cover with styrofoam cones or burlap or any of that, don't plant them. I'll tell you how to go ahead with the plants because you already have them. But here we are. Here I'm talking about, you know, making your winter landscape beautiful. I don't see a bunch of burlap encased plants out in my garden beautiful at all. So, like all good gardens and gardeners, you do a little research on your plants and really know if they are for us. And like I say, every once in a while, you might want to fool around with something, but you certainly don't want to depend on it. So if the recommendation is to cover them every year, I don't think it's worth having them personally. But in your situation, you have them. So his advice about putting a triangle of stakes around the plant because you want to completely surround it is okay. And often you use wood stakes and then the burlap you staple on. Mm-hmm. You don't want to actually wrap the plant with it. You want to keep an airspace around them because if you wrap it good, you might have disease problems or rodents and voles and rabbits find that the perfect spot to take residence for the winter. The one thing you'll want to do, which I mentioned earlier, is deeply water them. And maybe that's part of the issue. And of course, they're new plants. And even that first season, how far did that root system go out? Not very. So your new plants are the most subject to winter burn because of that. So keep them well watered. If we get a January thaw, as they say, and this is near a foundation of a house where that soil might not be frozen, you could give them another drink of water to help ensure it. And it, with that said, I don't know that she said what side of the house it was on, Larry, but...
Two sides, on the northeast.
Oh, northeast, okay.
And so then northwest. One on the northwest.
Yeah, northwest would be a little tougher, northeast would be okay. But again, what we're doing with that burlap is trying to keep the winter sun from hitting the plant, and it helps protect them from the wind, too, that can also dry them out.
Jamie in Green Bay, on to you now. Hi, Jamie.
Hi. I have a quick question and a quick comment. The question is, we're wondering about the name of the garden. We love, by the way, Olbrich. Okay. But is it Olbrich Botanic or Botanical Gardens?
It's Olbrich Botanical Gardens. And the name Olbrich comes from our founder, Michael Olbrich. Yep.
And the comment was about... controlling deer, keeping them out of a garden, we found that if you laid chain link fence down, not stand it up, but lay it down around the whole perimeter of the garden, and your grasses and things can grow up through it, and you can walk on it fine, but deer don't like to walk on that.
Nice.
On chain link fence.
Yeah.
You know, I could see where that could be.
Right. I know there's something like with cattle grates and such that they don't like that unsureness. Now, our previous caller was from Arborvitae, Wisconsin, where they probably get 4 feet of snow.
I'm not sure it would
work in all cases, but that's a good comment.
That's a good idea.
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks a lot, Jamie, for calling. Appreciate it. Oh, that's a good point. Angela in Crawford says, I'll be planting tulips after lunch today, and I'm sure the moles will be watching. Any ideas to keep moles away from the bulbs?
You bet. It is a problem this time of year if your chipmunks are still active, squirrels, voles, or meadow mice, as they're called, moles as well. What we found to work the best is when we plant our bulbs, we also mix in a handful of Milorganite fertilizer. And if you're familiar with that product, it's a composted sewage sludge from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Makes a great organic fertilizer. And if you've ever used it, you know it has a very pungent odor, especially when you first put it down. Well, we found that the animals don't like that at all, and they don't want to dig in it so much. And so we've had very good luck that way. So if you're doing a larger bed, you could mix it in with the bulb because it's good fertilizer too, so it'll help the bulb off to a good start. And then when you're all done, sprinkle some over
on
the whole top, and that does a pretty good job. Now, if it's even worse than that, I've heard people where they will plant their bulbs and put down then like chicken wire right on the surface or just barely below the surface, put your mulch over the top, and they won't be able to get at your bulbs, but yet the bulbs will be able to come up through that wire. And then you could, after you cut them back in the spring, you could, possibly take it off then. But that's a little more work. And, if you have other perennials in the bed and all that, that's a little tougher. But I've also heard of making sort of individual cages for them and surrounding the bulbs with them right down at, where the bulb is. So give them a little space, but then the bulbs, again, will come up through those without a problem.
A lot of work.
It is a lot of work, yeah. there's other ways to control
I like the Milorganite idea. That is a lot less work.
Absolutely. Or a good cat does a good job for you.
That works too.
Right.
Oh, well, you know, and there's lots always going on at Olbrich, and we'll be there this weekend because we definitely want to go and take a look and see what we haven't been there for. Like I said, I think it's been at least 3 weeks, maybe even a month.
Oh yeah, well you're due, and you know what's going on this weekend, which people love, is the Herb Fair, which is on Saturday from 9 till 2, and one of the employees the other day saying, "Oh, I love the Herb Fair. When you walk through the building, it just smells so wonderful."
So good.
Yeah, so that's going on. They have lots of herbal things for sale, and I'm sure you'll enjoy that. And like I said, it's beautiful, beautiful weekend. So get out in the garden, see it all.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Jeff. We'll get you back sooner.
Oh, later. I hope so. Thank you very much.
Jeff directs horticulture at Olbrich Botanical Gardens in Madison. Great to have him back. We'll get him back soon. We'll do it again. Peter Green joins us on Monday. Thank you for listening. Stay with us.